If you want to surprise the enemy, there are a few layers that has to be ready to do that. I mean, from the beginning to the top. So the war that we have planned for them was, and I think that this is something that has to be eventually sometimes said. I'm not sure if I said that before, so the brink would be the first to know.
How do you account for such an enormous success on the physical side, but such an enormous defeat, I think we can say, on the propaganda information war? How do you account for that imbalance?
First, I think that your description hurts, but it is the truth.
Everything that's happened in Israel has been so amplified on the world stage.
Correct.
Nothing more than the pager operation.
Right. Pagers, walkie-talkies. Do you know how many equipment, I mean, treated equipment do we have in these countries? You can't, you don't. I do.
You mean booby-trapped equipment?
Not only booby-trapped, manipulated equipment.
In which countries are you talking about?
All the countries that you can imagine.
The far-right ministers, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich in particular, how much do you think they drive government policy, or particularly the war, the campaign in Gaza?
So,
hello, and thank you for joining us on The Brink. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons.
And I'm Andrew Fox. And today, we're joined by Yossi Cohen, probably the world's most experienced and effective spymaster, who served as head of Mossad between 2016 and 2021, overseeing such spectacular operations as the audacious theft of Iran's nuclear archive in 2018 and the development of the booby-trapped pagers, which crippled Hezbollah last year. This is a man who has changed the course of world history.
Now, Yossi Cohen, who negotiated the Abraham Accords and has worked closely with Benjamin Netanyahu for years, has heavily hinted that he may run to become Israel's next prime minister. We'll be asking him all about that, as well as what it takes to be a spy, and his new book, The Sword of Freedom. It's time for Yossi Cohen, spymaster extraordinaire on The Brink. Yossi Cohen, thank you for joining us on The Brink.
Thank you very much for having me on The Brink.
Well, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, we were together a couple of days ago and we came up to a locked door, and inevitably somebody said, you can get us in with your special powers. Is that really annoying?
No, it's not.
People must say that to you all the time.
No, this, I mean, I would say that the expectations for us at the Mossad are enormous.
Yeah.
And for a good reason. I think that we can do through doors. I mean, we can go through doors and can go through different, whatever barriers and things that are stopping us from getting, I mean, what we want. And eventually, I mean, they will never stop us from getting what we want. I mean, we have to be very humble, I mean, to say that. But, you know, in a way, this is something that should be all the time achieved, because if there is something behind that wall that I need for the security and defense of my country, I will try to do my utmost to get it.
Right.
So
it's good to see that.
It is not annoying. I think that, I mean, probably this is the only organization on earth that receives, I mean, generally speaking, this kind of reputation from everybody. Everybody is expecting us exactly that,
right,
to do exactly that.
Right. Well, Jake and I are often accused of being in the pay of Mossad.
Exactly.
DNA. And actually, I was wondering, when is the money coming? Because I've not received any yet.
Which one?
The money from
your
the
checks?
Mossad.
Yeah. Let me check that. Yeah, let me check that. Yeah, you've never been paid, right?
No, not yet.
Yeah, we thought you were a volunteer.
For anyone at home, this is a joke, by the way. We're just joking. Yeah. But I just wondered, because it must be, after so many years, what, 38 years in the shadows for you, is it strange to relate to ordinary people who live according to the ordinary rules of life and live their lives in a normal way?
Well, I mean, you do live among normal people all the time, even if you are an operative. I mean, the life that are being there in front of you are normal life. I mean, we do travel in between normal life. You are in a kind of a simple, whatever, invisible cage, let's put it that way, or maybe kind of a mask, or simply say, cover story. I mean, and this is it. But you are walking between, let's say, normal people. I mean, you do operate. They don't know that you do. You're kind of a secret agent, I mean, running in between normal people. I mean, you travel in normal aircrafts, normal trains, normal cars, normal motorcycles. I mean, you go to normal hotels, you go to normal places, you go to normal whatever, all sites that you have to go in beside that you are.
But you always feel different.
You do feel different. You do feel different. I mean, it is something that you wear on you, I mean, from the first moment that you leave our international airport, or if you've been deployed abroad, I mean, every time that you go to work, you do feel different. You feel you're on the mission all the time. I mean, the danger is always there. The risk is always there. I mean, there's something that could go wrong every second minute because of two facts. One, you may make a mistake. Number two, you don't know what the enemy sees. Not all the time you see that the enemy is not seeing us the way we think that we're covered, not really, or maybe, God forbid, not be really be the truth. So he may see something that we don't see and may suspect something that we are not suspecting. And you may travel as a normal guy, but you're not. For us, you're invisible, but for the enemy, you are visible. So it's a kind of a thing that you have to be aware of, about all the time. That's why the level of alert is so high all the time.
And how did you find switching off? Because when I was in Afghanistan, clearly you're patrolling, you're constantly scanning. Every time you stop, you're checking 5-20 meters, course. Heads on a swivel. I found when I came back, I was doing that on British streets as well. So if I was walking down the street, I'd still be scanning. And right. It took a good while before that.
Yeah, you never switch off.
Do you
never switch off.
You never do.
You never switch off. It's kind of I mean, they train us. I mean, and I do remember that. I mean, along the training, I mean, there is something in the training. It's like in dancing or in music, in playing music. I mean, you do things then automatically, right? You have to get to the point that you don't really think how to change gears in the car or what is the right leg doing and the left leg. I mean, and the brakes, where are they? What you do things automatically. That's the way you operate. All right. You have to go, I mean, into the operation. I mean, thinking about who you are and what you do all the time, being so much alert. But these things, I mean, you do automatically so they can never stop.
That must be a tremendous stress.
Yeah, when I go on the streets of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or London, I mean, I'm still looking behind. I mean, trying to see if there is someone that is looking at me differently. Who is the guy in the lobby? Why do you have these flowers? I mean, in this direction, not that direction. Who is the, whatever, the cleaning service, I mean, in my room? Is she real or it's all the time then? Not paranoia, of course. But yeah, I mean, kind of a, whatever. I mean, deep education. I mean, I think I wrote it. I mean, the gene that I refer to, probably this is something that could be explained.
In fact, it's something I wanted to ask about because as a journalist, we obviously have none of that training, none of that experience. But sometimes on occasion, I've been in situations where it's been dangerous. And there's one, and I'm always interested about my emotional reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular, on this one occasion, I was reporting in Venezuela, in Caracas, which is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. And I interviewed the boss of a kidnap gang. And in order to interview him, I had to allow myself to be kidnapped by the gang.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into the favela, into the slum. We were jumped by these guys with guns, taken into this place, took all our stuff off us. And then I had this guy in front of me and I had to interview him.
Quietly.
With all these guys,
like they are pointing their guns to.
Yeah, but like they weren't even. They were walking around. They were all stoned on drugs, and they were walking around. One of them had a steak knife, and they just like stood behind. And so it was high pressure. And I knew that if I didn't get the interview, if I was too scared to get the interview, that the whole thing would have been pointless.
Right.
So I found that in a way, like my emotions switched off, and I just did the interview, and then went home, and then I got back to the hotel, and suddenly I had this huge exhilaration and I just wanted to eat meat. I don't know why I wanted to eat meat. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Now, how could I have done that in a better way as a from a professional point of view? How would
right. I think that you've done beautifully. I mean, like Andrews discusses when you go out of the battlefield, I mean you'd been in yours, right? I mean your battlefield that you'd been in is exactly something that I would say being a kind of a resembling, I mean, the operational arena, right? Or the operational facts that you're in a different situation that you have to be the same as you'd been before. And you're going through a kind of a bubble, right? I mean, there is this bubble of kidnapping you. And then you have to play right. I mean, because this is the point. I mean, you can't be now scared to say, oh my God, this is not the case. I want to go home. I mean, you go and I mean, leave me alone. I mean, I forget about the interview or I forget about the Afghanis or I will forget about the Iranians and let me go home. No. That's exactly the case.
The emotional switch off was.
It's not emotional. It's like emotional control. You don't really switch off your emotions, but you control them better. And very few can do that. I mean, I've seen soldiers who run away from battlefields. I mean, in First Lebanon War, I've seen partially. I mean, you don't have many because we've been trained for so long. So you do know what's going to happen. But some said, okay, whoa, that's the first bus control. I'm not going to do that. That's too much, and they go back. I mean, very few, super few, right? I mean, if I can say that. But it's not an emotional switch off. It's an emotional control. I mean, these are the guys. I mean, you ask people that are like in front of audience, can anyone speak in front of 1,000 people? Can anyone do it? Can you? How can you dance like that so beautifully? How can you sing or play in front of 10,000, 20, 50,000 people? How do you do that? All right. Some say we cannot.
But this is life or death. I mean, your experience of it as well. You know, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's the control you talk about. And I think that's trained in, isn't it? Because we talk about controlled violence. So as a paratrooper, my soldiers were incredibly violent when they needed to be. But it's the ability to then, when you don't need to be violent anymore, you stop and you can switch it off completely rather than red mist, you know, losing control completely.
So it's, you do not operate when you don't have to. I mean, this is the thing. Practice, I mean, you do not interview when you don't have to. You do not fight when you don't have to. You do not spy, whatever, when you don't have to. Right? I mean, there's a kind of a profession that has to be activated on the right stage. I mean, if you're not there, by the way, if you are doing it, okay, after work's time, or after the, I mean, that's a problem. If you keep on doing what you do, if you keep on doing, being violent, I mean, in many, I mean, mainly on battlefield, but not only on our cases too. I mean, people that are not psychologically in the right position to switch on and off or to control their emotions and they bring work back home, that's a problem.
Are you tempted to spy on your family sometimes?
No,
where
I
are
don't.
My kids? No,
I don't. I mean, they're so much better than me. I would never, I would never find them. I mean, they're whatever.
So we're talking about your book today. We've got a copy here. It's already a bestseller. The Sword of Freedom. Obviously, it's the most fascinating period in recent history in the Middle East. Everything that's happened in Israel has been so, you know, amplified on the world stage.
Correct.
Nothing more than the pager operation. And, you know, there are a number of fascinating things you talk about, like the Iranian nuclear archive and the Fakhrizadeh assassination. But I think pagers is the one that really caught the world's attention most recently. When we were speaking to Yoav Gallant about this, he was saying that there was a plan prior to that that he wanted to activate just after 7th of October, involving the walkie-talkies and the vests. And he thinks they could have taken out the whole of Hezbollah's leadership and 15,000 fighters all at once. What was the decision making from your perspective that went into that, you know, whether it was the pages a year later or just after 7th of October, how did that decision get made?
Right. The decision that was taking, I mean, to finally go into a full scale war with Hezbollah was the right one. Wrongly, I think that Yoav Gallant said that it was, better to do that on October 8th. I mean, I will remind everybody what October 8th looked like. All right. The state of Israel was terrified. It was horrified. All right. Because of that very terrible and the very exhausting situation that nobody really knew what's happening. Not Yoav Gallant, neither the chief of staff or the Air Force or the prime minister or any other citizen.
Or the head of Mossad.
Okay. Or head of, former head of Mossad for sure. I hope that maybe head of Mossad as well. Nobody really knew what's happening. Right? And how did it happen? Where are they? I mean, terrorists were traveling inside our country, in our side major cities, not only on the borderline. I mean, they go into the road
and off. Is Iran going to attack?
They're being, I mean, far away from their border. I'm on our side and we're not sure. I mean, and an answer to like, is it clear? Is it clean? I mean, do we have more? I mean, where are they? How many hostages? Where are the hostages? Where are the babies? I mean, where are you? Right. And I think that it took us a long time to understand who's doing what and where are the army units? What happened to our army camps? What happened to the kids that were at the army camps, inside their camps? I mean, kind of a thing that shows what was the level of alert inside the IDF. I mean, nothing will happen. I mean, we can have our kids inside the camps. All right. You're aware of that, right? I mean, you know that many, many, many kids were there. I'm not sure how many.
Visiting the camps on the border. Sukkot,
for the camp. Yeah, for the holiday.
Just when the attack happened.
Just for the holiday. I mean, and like very young kids. I mean, it's not like whatever teenagers who have driving license can say, okay, if worse comes to worse. I mean, you jump in the car, you go home to Tel Aviv, right? No. Little kids. They can do nothing. I mean, so you do not suspect that nothing will happen. So on that case, when we didn't have a clue of what's happening in the state of Israel, inside the country and outside of the country, I mean, the wrong thing would have been, and I'm happy that no one received the Afghan statement or proposal, if he did, All right. If he did propose that.
He says the prime minister said no.
Okay. I agree with the prime minister to his no. Why is it? Because the last thing that you want to do when you are attacked by one front and not knowing what's happening is to open another one when you're not ready for that. Let me tell you about the pagers. And I think that this is something that has to be eventually sometimes said. I'm not sure if I said that before. So probably the Brink would be the first to know.
Exclusive.
When you plan a war against Iran, or when you plan a war against Hezbollah, all right, there are layers in that war that has to be planned in advance. Okay? So now you go into two different situations strategically. The first one is I will react. They will start, I will do something. What is it that I will do? Accordingly, there is a menu. How many did they do? How many did they kill? How many did they stubborn? How many did they whatever? Okay, I mean, we'll see. Okay, accordingly, I mean, you will retaliate accordingly. If they've done a lot, we'll do a lot. Okay, simple thing. Banal, in a way. Israel will defend itself by itself, ba-ba-bam, all these kind of very important titles. But in the end of the day, if you want to start, what we call it, if you want to surprise the enemy, there are a few layers that has to be ready to do that. I mean, from the beginning to the top, from up till the last thing that has to be activated. So the war that we have planned for them was pages level one, walkie-talkies number two. Then they will understand that we are about to come, right? And then Air Force and Army, full-fledged, everything will be against them. I mean, you don't...
Against Hezbollah or against Iran?
Hezbollah.
Just Hezbollah, right.
Hezbollah mainly.
Right.
Hezbollah mainly.
Right.
And this is something that has to be eventually understood and said. So when the Minister of Defense says, we'll get them both together at the same time, when the army is not ready, now we are recruiting 500,000 people, right, in one Saturday. All right. Are you really ready? You know, I told the Prime Minister the first day of the wars, I told him, I think it's in my book, but I, maybe good that that we've mentioned that because you've like, started me on.
Dick.
I told him, they will tell you they are ready. They're not. They will tell you that we know. They don't. They will tell you that they have enough intelligence. They don't. Check it again and again and again. In simple ways, or in simple different words, don't rush. Prepare it and then go. And eventually this is what I did. Not only because of me. By the way, it was not a private meeting. I do not believe in private meetings. Not on that case. Military secretary was there. Tsachi Hanegbi, I mean, the national security advisor was there. Yaakov Nagel, the professor, whatever, was there. Ron Derman was there. I was speaking to them all. I told them, don't rush. Don't rush. I know my kids. I know my son-in-law. I know these that had fought eventually on October 8th already. October 7th and 8th. From the first days. And then for long months, right? I mean, they're coming from Tel Aviv and Modi'in.
Now, in your book, you describe the people who were in charge on October the 7th and before in quite critical terms. You say they were like a close-knit load of people who didn't listen to the outside. They were too friendly with each other. They were too, they like an echo chamber.
Right.
And when you first came in as head of Mossad, you saw that there was not enough intelligence coming in from Gaza. You begged to be put in charge of Gaza. And then the Shabak, the Shin Bet, the equivalent of the MI5, blocked you from that.
And the military IDF as well. The intelligence of the IDF as well.
Right. So do you include the Prime Minister in that?
Well, in the end of the day, Prime Minister would do things according to his consultants.
Really?
Not. Yeah, really. I mean, he consults a lot, by the way. I mean,
but he opposed Gallant's recommendation to attack Hezbollah.
Yeah, probably someone else told him don't.
Right.
Maybe the chief of staff.
You did.
I was not there. I did, but, you know, not in an official, discussion, but probably he listened to me, and I'm happy he did, by the way. I mean, look at what we've done. Look at how much we had to stress. Okay. We had to push back. I mean, first, I mean, terrorism conducting war inside Israel, and then all the rest. That took us months. I mean, 2 years.
Yeah.
And we have it done, right? I mean, it's a too long war happening right now in Gaza Strip because of the indecisive status of the war. And we can discuss that because I'm not really sure what's happening there. But I would try.
In terms of the culture, just before
but the culture, the culture is part of it because the culture says, in many ways, we're okay, right? We don't need you. We're fine. Don't tell us what to do. I mean, we are the IDF. We are Shabak, like equivalent to MI5, right? Wrong. Wrong. You have to be super humble. And when I actually did that for the first time in my book, right, I said, okay, now it's not an interview. It's a document. That's mine for life.
Your book?
My book.
Yeah.
All right. This is the first book I write, probably not the last one. I hope not the last one. But that's an important statement. So I said, I'll take my gloves off a little bit. I have more to say, but I will never, or not now, not publicly. I'll take it off a little bit because the people should know, all right, my position. The people should know Mossad's position. The people should know and appreciate Mossad's capabilities more. Now, when you do that in Lebanon, and when you're so low in Gaza, what do you think? What do you propose to the country? And this is my proposition, because in the end of the day, it's not only to be critics about what has happened, but to be constructive about what do we have to do next. And what do we have to do next? We have to do that. How do we do that? Think or consider or imagine that West Bank, Judea and Samaria will be fallen into the hands of Hamas. Is that an option? Yes. Why is it that Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas does all this coordination with us? Because he won't survive without us.
Mm.
Okay, he can be as brave as he wants. We'd cut relationship with the
security
state of Israel.
Coordination.
He cannot cut relationship with us. Not economically and defense-wise, of course not. So the message of the criticism, let's put it that way, which is criticism, I would say constructive criticism, all right, if there is something like that, is not only to look at the back and says, you see, told you, right? I told you that you have nothing sufficient on the level of intelligence. I told you, I wrote it. By the way, if you had met my subordinates now, everybody remembers that.
Mm.
Everybody in the organization remembers, everybody at the Shabak remembers. Why is it that they hadn't denied that openly? It's there in the open. Let me hear you say, no, not true. Of course it is the truth. This is exactly what
happened. Everyone in Israeli politics is saying, I was talking about Gaza before anybody else.
Not true.
Everyone's trying to distance
themselves. Yeah, I know. And more than that, I mean, some would say, I mean, Yossi brought the money from the Qataris.
Yeah.
Which is, I have mitigated the money from the Qataris. I mean, that was the Israeli policy, and I've conducted the Israeli policy accordingly. I mean, I'm a very, I'm kind of a soldier, right? I mean, there
are orders. This is money that came from the Qataris into Gaza that people criticized for funding Hamas.
Right, but yeah. I said that openly, right? When the funding was eventually proposed by either the IDF or together with the Shabak and all the mechanism, all right, like to pour this money into the civilian pockets in Gaza, was not controlled by the Mossad. That was a kind of a local Israeli thing that we didn't do. My part of that job was to bring or to convince the Qataris to pay money for the civilians, only for the civilians, not for the Hamas whatsoever. But the level of intelligence is something that I didn't sleep for 38 years because of that.
Yeah.
Okay, this is what I did for a living, right? Day and night and day and night, 24/7, 365 days a year, for longer than 38 years because of the army. But, okay, when you do understand that the level of intelligence is so poor, do something about that.
But there's something that you wanted to ask about, because, you know, you talk about Lebanon capabilities and Iran being up here and Gaza being down there, but in a way...
Did you see any surprises in Gaza?
Surprises?
Yeah.
Like, you mean intelligence surprises?
Pages, walkie-talkies. Do you know how many treated equipment we have in these countries?
Mm.
You don't. I do.
You mean booby-trapped equipment?
Not only booby-trapped.
And spying.
Manipulated equipment. All right?
In which countries are you talking about?
All the countries that you can imagine.
And not Gaza?
Not Gaza.
Nothing in Gaza at all.
Did you see that? If we had it, I mean, we knew something about them coming. Something, right? I would have sold them everything. Just everything. I mean, you can't imagine the quantity. When I have invented that method, that was in 2002 to 2004.
The pager method.
The manipulated equipment method. Okay. We have already used it. manipulated equipment in Second Lebanon War, some of the elements were speaking to us.
How did you use it?
Want a glass of water?
We can get some brandy.
He could tell you, but he didn't.
It's an early morning in London. I mean, I don't think that is the case. But how did we do it? I tell you how. Yeah. We want to do that. I truly believe is if there is something as you've studied, there is something behind that wall that I need. Okay, and people will try to avoid me from doing it. Right, I will find a way to get there. I have to find a way to get there. Right? And if I know that Hezbollah or Iran or other countries or other organizations are buying something that I can be part of their supply chain, I will do, but that has to be decided. Why is it? Because my best partner at the time, when I have invented that, was the chief or the head of the tech division at the Mossad.
Q.
The Q, right. Mm. Yeah. And he had to be my best partner because without him, I'm nothing.
So
I think, please.
I think, you know, the high tech stuff is very sexy and very cool. Tanks, fighter jets, explosions are very cool. And Israel's had huge success in all of those things. In your book, you talk about the other aspect, which is the information. The propaganda war, should we say.
Oh.
You talk about
psychological war, you mean?
Yeah, and you talk about the 54-1 TikTok ratio. So 54 pro-Palestinian TikToks for every pro-Israeli one.
That's the number. I thought it's higher on the Palestinian side.
Yeah, but either way,
it's a
huge overmatch. So you've got all the cool kit and the cool stuff, but they've got this incredible propaganda campaign that has you portrayed as genocidal and apartheid and all that sort of nonsense that comes out. Now, I'd make a case, I think, that Israel's international isolation is almost as much, if not more, of a security threat than certainly Hamas poses right now.
Of course it is.
So how do you account for such an enormous success on the physical side, but such an enormous defeat? Mm-hmm. I think we can say, on the propaganda information war. How do you account for that imbalance?
First, I think that your description hurts, but it is the truth. And the fact is that we didn't fail. We just don't do it.
Mm. Didn't try.
Okay, we didn't even try to do it. At the beginning of the war, and Israel, by the way, is not doing it for many years. You have beautiful ambassadors out there. I mean, there is a Ministry of Foreign Affairs, full-fledged ministry. We're not using it. There's kind of a huge gap in between the Prime Minister's office and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for years. The Prime Minister's office does not respect the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, not like here in the UK. Okay, when I spoke to my counterpart at the MI6, he said, my boss is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Minister.
Foreign Secretary.
Not the PM. Okay, it's a different thing. I mean, for deniabilities and liabilities and all that. I mean, there is, the Prime Minister could say, I was not aware of that, right? And I mean, it's my ministers have decided that. But there is a huge gap in between what we can do and what we're doing. And I don't think that we even tried. I don't think that we've even tried. And for sure, the other side is trying so hard. And unfortunately, I mean, look at the Prime Minister's speech yesterday at the UN. It was an empty hall. There's no one there. Why? Isn't the UN meant to be the place for open conversation with all countries? Now, the president of Iran, a mass killer, would enter the site, same stupid, ugly green marble behind, which I know, and for many years I've been to the UN. Nobody would go. No one would leave. And where is it that we're in? What is the situation that we're in? Unfortunately, your description is absolutely right. And I think that what we have to do, we have to try do that. Explaining what the PR of the State of Israel could not be done only by the Prime Minister once in a while. You have to have a super huge division of people that are being recruited to that mission, would be happily being recruited to that. You know how many people approach me and say, Why don't we do that? Same question. Mm. Where are we? I mean, not only Jewish people around the world, but others too that do care about our existence and do believe that we have the right and the just and to fight Hamas and other terrorists around the world. What's happened? And you know, every time that the credit is going high, let's say after the pages, it crashes immediately down. We've done something very nice in Iran. I mean, because we had to, let's say, destroy the sites. I mean, it stays there at the beautiful positive PR for
5 minutes.
5 minutes, mm. few days, boom, it crashes immediately down. And now we have to negotiate with Iran. We re-welcome Iran back to the, no, I mean, yesterday it was decided, I mean, to reload heavy sanctions on the Iranian, which I'm, it's a Security Council, I mean, last night. So I'm very happy with it. But yes, I mean, the good things that we're doing, not only for the sake of the state of Israel, but I think that the good things that we're doing for the world would stay there for short. Why is it? Because the huge quantity of people would counter that. And we're not doing much about that.
So you mentioned the Prime Minister and his speech at the UN. Your book mentions him several times. You mentioned that he has poor communication or empathetic style with ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
You say, I've got a couple of quotes actually. Many would consider it fanciful that he considers himself Churchillian. He lacks the inspirational personality that registers with a man and woman on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about his lack of, I'm quoting again, lack of personal chemistry with regional leaders,
mm-hmm.
which undermines his status in the Middle East and emphasizes a recurring flaw in his premiership. And you say that he's got a divisive administration now because of the far right members of it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a different sector.
Okay, that's
I mean, the first two quotes are describe his capabilities. By the way, a very smart guy. He was a good prime minister for long. I think that he has a lot of achievements, right? That has to be given to him as well.
Yeah.
But what I describe is a kind of a whatever things that he doesn't have. I agree with my descriptions. Okay. Have to agree with that. And lacking all that is kind of a problem.
See, that's really interesting because I had a meeting with Bibi last year and my takeaway was...
In private?
It was about 12 of us, yeah. So it was
12 of you.
12 of us in a room, yeah, with Bibi. And
mm-hmm. generals, I mean from...
So foreign generals. And
foreign generals.
And I was the reporter for the right. visit, so I was taking okay. notes. General McColl was giving him both barrels. It was quite funny.
Okay.
But I thought he was one of the most charismatic people I've ever met in person. But also I would never have bought a used car from him.
Why?
Because he just didn't come across as trustworthy.
Right. So this is exactly what I describe. I mean, he lives in between himself, right? He's in his own, he's very much aware, I mean, to the things that he has to say, but he's not aware of the things that you perceive him saying.
Mm.
Okay. I don't think that he has the capabilities to recruit. Right?
To recruit.
People. I mean, to recruit targets.
For the Mossad.
Like we do. Yeah, for Mossad or for any other mission. Yes, he is charismatic. And he probably one of the best, speech givers. I mean, whatever. I mean, you can call it. I mean, in the world. I mean, he knows. I mean, his English is perfect and he knows how to play right. You like it or not? I'm not sure if you like the substance of it. Okay. I mean, there's a lot to say about the substance, about the gimmicks, about the placards, about all that. I mean,
the QR code.
The QR code. I mean, there are all many, many, many things that are happening around him that I'm not sure if I like or dislike, but that's not the case. I think that there are some things in him that do not translate rightly, communicating with leaders. I don't care about him not communicating with the street rightly. That's probably a campaign that he can do, right? It doesn't go to places, I mean, to shake hands or, you know.
With bereaved widows.
Right. I mean, as we say, to kiss babies, right? I mean, you always say that, I mean, don't go to kiss. And, but I think that he has a kind of a gap in between where he thinks he is and when the leaders believe he is. And it's interesting what you said. He said he's super charismatic, so why not buying a used car from him?
You're saying he believes his own hype.
And this is the thing. It is all aspects in life. Charisma is not enough. It's a tool. If you have it, you have it. You know, charm is like something that you receive, like the ability to play or the ability to dance or the ability to be a pilot. I mean, you don't, you can be trained upon your own capabilities that were given. Charm is a given, right? Either you have it or not, but it's not enough. You have to add into it something, substance, at the substance level that would say, we trust you. Look what you said. He's charming, but I don't trust him. This is what you said, right? So why is it?
Let me read you these three sentences from here, okay?
Please.
Page 123. Power is, by its nature, does not necessarily corrupt. But if you cling on too long in the belief you are invulnerable, you invite trouble. Never think you're the only savior in town. That confidence verges on arrogance. It corrupts the soul and saps the spirit of those around you.
Absolutely.
Who are you thinking of?
Yeah. My mother-in-law. No, I don't. I don't know.
Oh, now you're really in trouble.
No. Edit. Cut it out. No, please. I mean, she's still there waiting for me with a black, whatever. Of many.
You think it's time for something new?
I think the appearance is different than the substance all the time. Charm is, I mean, has a gap, I mean, between being charmier or charmy, and the real thing that you do. And you can't always, perceive yourself as the only one saver or as the only one that is probably the solution for the country, for the world, for your people. I mean, some can do that. Not many probably, but some can do it. Yeah, I can think of some. I mean, not only on one person. And if your ego is too developed, I think that you are blocking yourself from criticism and from self-understanding. I mean, if you'll go see my kids or my subordinates, they will tell you the only ultimate one test that I believe in is this, the mirror test. This is what I call it, Mifchana Mar'ah in Hebrew. Stand in front of the mirror, tell yourself who you are. Do you really believe in what you say? Do you really present your truth out there? If so, you're a good person. Okay, and you read from within. Some has to be, of course, I mean, played differently because you don't want to tell everybody everything about everything, right? But if you stand in front of the mirror and say, okay, I am the one that I consider to be, I will tell them that this is who I am.
This is a question that we asked Yoav Gallant as well, who's worked with Bibi a lot. The far-right ministers, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich in particular, how much do you think they drive the policy, government policy, or particularly the war, the campaign in Gaza?